Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark Liberty, and joining me today is...
Carotid script alert, open parentheses, Corey Knockreiner, close parentheses, carotid forward slash script.
I think we just got cross-site scripted audibly by Corey there. As he may have just hinted at, on today's episode, we'll cover a couple important news items, including a recent wave of ransomware attacks against various organizations, and a deprecation of a couple of protocols that should have died long ago. But after that, we are going to jump into the world of cross-site scripting and discuss one prevention technology to help combat this web application flaw that so many websites still seem to have issues with. With that, let's go ahead and inject our way in.
I can't seem to remember if I actually remembered to close parentheses my name. I'm sure there's some web developer will tell me how I screwed up the syntax of my alert script.
So today, I feel like we should start with just a look at what honestly feels like a bit of a ransomware resurgence. Like, I know we've talked about how ransomware plateaued in 2016, and in reality, it really has. Like, ransomware volume as a whole is still nowhere near the levels that it was in 2016 in terms of unique victims infected. But just over the last week or week and a half, there have been some pretty high profile ransomware attacks that I feel like we deserve a little coverage on this podcast. Like, starting with just last week, some security researchers stumbled on the payment negotiation dashboard set up by the threat actor Reval, or Sode no Kibi, or whatever you want to call them. For negotiations with one of their latest victims, which,
by the way, I pronounced it Reval, just so those know, it's evil with the R in front of it.
Yeah. So this was a negotiation dashboard for one of their latest victims, which was the computer manufacturer Acer. And on this page, the researchers found that Reval or Sode no Kibi were demanding $50 million in Monero cryptocurrency to regain access to their files, and the price would be doubling to $100 million on March 28th if they didn't pay by then.
By the way, a little diversion, but just so you know, these payment CNCs are often not hard to find. You might wonder, how do researchers stumble on them? One, they're actually passed around quite a bit, even in pretty open underground marketplaces, because they're where these threat actors go to kind of share the leaks they have, which may later be sold. But the other reason is, like, when you get a ransomware variant, you know, the first thing ransomware has to do is give you typically an onion link, a Tor site, where you have to go make payment. So for, you know, once you have a sample of ransomware, it's often pretty easy to find these payment sites. Now, there's probably pages on these payment sites that are just for, like each variant of Reval to each targeted victim might have this slightly different, let's call it a key, that gets you to a special page. But even that wouldn't be hard to find if you got the exact sample that a particular victim has. Because again, the victim, needs that
the
information. Yeah. Well, that's kind of how the ransomware authors treat it. You're now a customer of my forced business. But
do they accept tips?
I'm sure they would. But if you negotiate, they're going to double their price. Anyways,
exactly.
So really, once you have samples, these are kind of hidden in plain sight. They're meant to be found. But it was interesting seeing them actually get the exact one for Acer, because they had the little, I guess we might chat about it, but they had the chat mechanism. So the researchers behind this could even see some of the back and forth chat from allegedly or presumably an Acer employee and the actual threat actor. And basically the threat actor was saying, "You're kind of a crappy negotiator. You should talk to your boss."
Yeah. It was actually pretty funny. Like, the guy was saying, "I need to go back to my boss with something. You care about money. I care about my job. So give me something I can take back." And the Reval guy's like, "You suck, give me someone else."
I know this is a little diversion, but we're on this topic of ransomware, which isn't researching in volume, but is definitely researching in targeted attacks. One of the common advice I've seen people give, especially kind of White Tower security folks or folks that are in the government side, is they recommend companies that get ransomware get a negotiator. I actually don't know. I think that comes from like police authority, FBI background, where they negotiate with real people and they think it's helpful. But a lot of these ransomware threat actors kind of laugh at the negotiator. They essentially have all the, if you're in a situation where you're even considering to pay the ransom, they have the power. So while I do think sometimes they've been able to negotiate from maybe say a $15 million ransom to a lower one, in many cases we've seen these threat actors kind of laugh and bait the negotiator and then say, okay, the price is double now. So I'm not entirely sure how much you should invest in professional negotiation if you ever got infected. No, it's an aside.
If the ransom was $50 million, though, it might worth hiring on an expert. Yeah.
For sure. But don't be surprised if it doubles, not only based on you not paying in time, but et cetera. So.
Exactly. And with some of these ransomware strains lately, it seems like the threat actors, it's not just encrypting all of your files, but they steal a bunch of them too. And they hold that over you as well and say, if you don't pay, not only are you not getting access to your files back, but we're going to release all of your sensitive information on the underground. And more often than not, it feels like they actually hold true to that and do end up dumping a whole lot of company information on underground forums.
They absolutely do. And I think some of these payment sites also act as leak sites for the underground community to know that there's a potential for this data. I will say the one thing that I you know, double ransoms, obviously they're extra bait for you to pay. But I now that they're doing this, it just makes me think less of paying for ransomware because, yes, there is some truth to if I'm a ransomware author and you do end up paying, I want to make sure my world of victims knows that I follow what I say, so maybe I don't exfiltrate the data. But the truth is, you don't know. Even if you do pay, they have your data. They've taken it from you. I find it hard to believe that they'll just delete it. Maybe they won't release it to the underground because they don't want their victims to know. But I wonder if that data will come to haunt you years later. I mean, these are criminals. So you know, I guess this is me still saying paying ransom is something you really, really should avoid. But now that they're doing double ransom, even if they temporarily live up to not leaking your data, I'm not sure you're in a good situation either way.
It is like a really good point. Like it's pretty likely they wouldn't flat out release it onto a forum after negotiating something like that with you. Because like you said, they do have
their next victim
a reputation for whatever it is. Yeah. But they 100% are still holding on to it. There's no way they delete that. And then all it takes is for them to turn around and get hacked by someone else or have some sort of leak. And suddenly all of your documents and information get dumped anyway. Like it's really a crummy
situation. There's other ways they can monetize it. I mean, sometimes this data is your partners and clients. They have all your partners' account IDs. They have payment information you've made. So even if they don't leak it, it really is pay dirt for them that they can probably monetize in all kinds of different ways beyond just leaking it to the world.
So I wonder if like Revil has any relationship to those emails they keep getting out offering me lists of all of our competitors' customers then.
That is the interesting way for those email list builders to build their lists. Frankly would not be surprised if the legitimate lists used for marketers are somehow attached to some of the spamming lists that also happen.
Yeah. So we still don't know exactly how this ransomware attack happened. In fact, Acer hasn't even confirmed that there was a ransomware attack yet, even though basically all signs and evidence point to, yes, there was. There were earlier reports that threat actors were targeting Acer's Exchange servers with that recently discovered proxy logon exploit. But again, Acer haven't confirmed that or even the existence of the intrusion in the first place. And over the last few weeks, there have also been several other security researchers and organizations that have confirmed that several ransomware variants, including one by Black Kingdom and another one called Deer Cry, have specifically been targeting vulnerable Exchange servers and even the back doors that the Hafnium exploits left behind in order to gain access and then deploy ransomware on internal infrastructure. So it looks like that's, I mean, just like Eternal Blue was back in the day with WannaCry, and Bluekeep was also a year or so ago. Like, these latest Microsoft vulnerabilities seem to have opened the floodgates for yet more ransomware attacks against organizations that haven't patched.
Certainly feels that way. And by the way, for the folks that listen to our podcast, I think it was just last week, but we do have signatures for this. But the only thing I want to add to it is we're starting to look at the data that's gathering for Q1, for our Q1 internet security report. And one of our analysts, Trevor, has already noticed that the Hafnium signature, the proxy login signature for the remote exploit, is being hit quite a bit. Now, on one hand, that's good to see because we're seeing this because there's fireboxes out there properly configured to block it, and it is blocking it. But it just kind of, it's fuel to prove what you're saying, Mark, that this is a very popular exploit. If you haven't taken care of it, I can't imagine any situation where you don't know about this by now and haven't taken care of it. But if you haven't, it's probably already too late, but you should definitely think about it. And meanwhile, definitely configure any products you have like a Firebox to block it. Do know, because Outlook Web Access uses HTTPS, you do have to set up a HTTPS proxy, and you have to configure our device right, but it does work. Mark has helped folks set it up properly.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Acer wasn't the only organization hit with ransomware recently. Also last week, one of the largest IoT manufacturers, Sierra Wireless, reported that they had been the victim of a ransomware attack affecting much of their production and manufacturing sites, as well as their corporate IT infrastructure. In fact, as of right now, their website is still offline, saying it's in undergoing maintenance. And man, this feels kind of like the Norsk Hydro thing all over again. Obviously, IoT is a little bit different from a massive aluminum manufacturer, but ransomware crippling a manufacturing line is another, basically one of our predictions of, what was it, yeah, last year or year before?
Yeah, I think it was for 2020, and so our 2020 predictions last year. Yeah, no, definitely a big deal. And by the way, this one may even have more collateral damage among the normal people listening to this podcast. I mean, an aluminum manufacturer could have global implications, but not a lot of us are buying aluminum directly, but a bit more normal businesses might touch Sierra Wireless as far as products and stuff. So definitely implications on supply chains.
And in another vertical as well, CNA Financial, which is one of the United States' largest insurance providers, also revealed that they were hit with a cyber incident disrupting certain systems, including corporate email, which again, wow, signs their point to another ransomware attack.
That seems like lawyer speak for saying there was an incident, but not wanting anyone to know what kind.
Exactly. And if this were like one of the newer flavors of ransomware, where not only do they encrypt your stuff, but they steal it. I mean, I couldn't picture a better target for a ransomware threat actor than a insurance company that does cyber insurance. Because now have lists of customers with how big their policies are, and you know exactly how and how much to target them for.
By the way, this actually, there's a blog called The Record from Recorded Future, and they have an alleged interview with one of these Revel, a person that's supposed to be part of this group. One of the predictions I made, I think it was 3 years ago, was that cyber insurance might help fuel. I talk about how cyber insurance's desire to pay for ransoms, or them actually paying for ransoms as part of their extortion insurance, is just going to fuel this. And if you read the Recorded Future interview with this Revel guy, he basically, you know, he talked about this. He talked about infiltrating cyber insurers specifically because it gives them a great list of victims. So I highly recommend you just look up for interview Revel on the Record blog, and you'll find that interview. It's pretty, you know, it's hard to say whether he really is the guy, he or she, but they make a pretty good argument for why they probably are. And hearing the way he talks about his victims, and he talks about cyber insurance, and by the way, he also talks about the negotiators. So I'd highly recommend you read that interview just to get the threat actor's perspective for these attacks.
Yeah, it was super interesting. Again, you have to take it with a little bit of a grain of salt because there's no definitive proof. But it, like, if it were to be a true interview with someone from Reval, this is exactly how I would have expected it to have played out. So still an interesting story regardless.
I actually think we keep on saying allegedly and not exact proof. But to give you an idea of why we even... I'm speaking for you too, Mark, but let me know if I'm wrong. I believe this Acer ransomware is likely, and it's because we visited this Onion site, and we've described the samples, but there's like 8 screenshots of data. So if you look at this data, they're not giving you the whole file for free. They're just showing you some things. It's kind of hard to dispute that this doesn't really come from some confidential source in Acer. And I imagine finding the interviewee probably was, you know, maybe even done through this Happy Blog, this Reval.
What a great name.
I know. That's what I think of when I think of ransomware infections. Happy. I guess happy, yeah, for the Reval guys. I'm sure there's some SMO in Russia that's pretty rich right now that's just a 24-year-old kid who couldn't find an IT job.
Exactly. So what can companies do to protect themselves against this? Like, obviously, backup and restoration is key when it comes to ransomware, but there's still the issue of data exfiltration too. So data loss prevention tools are pretty dang critical these days as well to try and catch that before it makes its way out.
Yeah, I think it's hard to just give you one silver bullet tip because it doesn't exist. But you've heard me and Mark talk about layered security all the time. It has to do with having a policy that has IPS signatures blocking certain vulnerabilities from your Exchange server and every other network server you happen to have that might have vulnerabilities. It has to do with patching things as soon as you can. It has to do with a lot of these targeted ransomware infections start with spear phishing emails. So even training your users, having proactive and more advanced malware detection to catch evasive ransomware, but then also have things like EDR, knowing that threats do get past the first layer of AV. So you need things that actually are constantly searching your endpoints and your internal networks for breaches that have already happened. So really, the tip is doing all the right best practices we've talked about, but you know, that's obviously work. It takes time and effort to create a security culture. But as we see more and more big companies getting popped and having significant financial implications because of it, it's at the point where all that work to make sure you're doing the best practices is really in your best interest.
Yeah, exactly. And really, like you said, there's not one thing you can do. And it's all about building the culture and then also setting up the tools and then just hoping for a little bit of luck along the way, too, to protect you from that one-off that comes through.
I will say, and I think I said this last time, too, but backup is critical. And the other half of this is you're never, ever, ever going to be 100% secure. Throwing time and money to try to reach some ivory tower standard of security won't work. So you do have to figure out what you do have to use typical risk management practices. Where are my data? Where is my data? What's the most important? And what should I spend the most money to protect? But ultimately, I would say it's clear that beyond just backup, a full business continuity and disaster recovery plan is something you need to have in place. You don't want to be making up your incident handling plan or your disaster recovery plan when you're literally in the middle of a disaster. You're going to fail and you're going to lose more money because of it. So you want to have this plan in place. Me and Mark get the benefit of saying backup, but you really should be doing some 3-2-2 backup. And by that, I mean, you know, 3-2-2 means having 3 different backups of your data. 2 means using 2 different types of backups. In the past, it was 2 different media. But since we don't use tapes as much nowadays, what it should mean is 2 different backup-like services, maybe one cloud-based, maybe one other product. And the other 2 is kind of having off 2 different places offline and at another location for your backups to be. And so what we say in simply backup your stuff is really a lot of work to get to the backups that will survive these. Do you know in these targeted attacks, the bad guys have usually compromised your network long before they installed the ransomware, and they've scouted your network. In the past, when you've been using like Veeam or other backup solutions, they've tried to find them and use privileged access to delete your backups. And that's why something like this 3-2-2 model is important, so that you have the offline and in different options for backups if they do get to some of them.
Yeah. And then again, not just taking backups, but testing them regularly as well, making sure that your restoration process will work in time of crisis. So that way you're not just caught with your pants down when it comes time for a ransomware attack.
Ultimately, we need to dry up the money source. You know, I understand if you're running a business and you didn't follow all the best practices, sometimes you have to figure out how to recover. But the truth comes down to, if they keep making money from it, especially in the millions, they're going to keep doing it. So we have to cut off this as a money source. And part of that is not paying ransom. Although the other part of that is the authorities need to start catching these folks.
Yeah. And I guess some of the good news on one of those fronts, well, good news depending on where you're at and getting infected, with those FinCEN alerts from like October of last year, where now they're going to start looking into ransom payments to potentially sanctioned nations as liable for organizations, will cut down on some of these ransom payments that are going out also. Anyways, scary times. Hopefully you guys have backups. Let's move on to a slightly happier story. So it was just this morning, I got the notification for something that has been coming for quite some time now. As of this day recording, so I guess last week when you're listening to it, the Internet Engineering Task Force, or IETF, has published RFC 8966, which is titled Deprecating TLS 1.0 and TLS 1.1. Before we dive into that, I want to point out the name of the draft version for this, because it was pretty dang funny. So prior to being an official RFC that's now been approved and ratified by the group, the draft was titled TLS old versions die, die, die.
Die, die, die. Yeah, I love it. It's nice to know us engineers have senses of humor, too.
A little bit of humor, yes. So this RFC officially deprecates TLS 1.0 and 1.1, noting that they lack support for current and recommended cryptographic algorithms, and various government and industry applications now mandate avoiding them. They listed out some rationale for it, which, I mean, it should seem obvious, but I guess when you're the group responsible for creating internet standards, you have to actually have quantifiable reasons. Like TLS 1.0 mandates support for a triple DES cipher that is fairly insecure these days. There's no support for currently recommended cipher suites, like the authenticated encryption with associated data ciphers, or AED. And also the handshakes and peer authentication integrity all rely on SHA-1, which is at least theoretically broken, if not necessarily in practice as of yet. I think there's been a few collisions people have been able to create, but it's not as bad as MD5 at least, but it is still going the way of the ghost and deprecated, which is why they're getting rid of it. They noted that the deprecation is intended to assist developers as additional justification for no longer supporting TLS versions, which I think is still probably a good reason and a good requirement. Like last I checked, actually this morning, courtesy of SSL Labs, they found that 54% of websites still support TLS 1.1 and 48 still support TLS 1.0. Interestingly enough, that's
higher than our numbers, but we did this in our security report. I think it was over a year ago now, right, Mark, where we use tools to actually do all kinds of SSL, built all kinds of TLS connections with various sites to see what versions they would allow. And that we really basically said exactly what they're doing now. You need to get to 1.2 and not do 1.0 or 1.1.
Yeah, like TLS 1.0 and even 1.1 have some vulnerabilities in them that are actual protocol vulnerabilities, like Beast, for example. Which is an attack against the cipher blockchaining encryption algorithms that TLS 1.0 uses. There was Poodle, which was technically an implementation flaw, but a difficult one to correct, and one that if you're still running 1.0, there's the chance that you didn't correct it. Like some of the good news is, like I said, this has been a long time coming. Most browsers ditched support of 1.0 and 1.1 around halfway last year. Like Firefox was going to do it in March. They actually had it ready to go, but reverted it in March because of COVID, after noting that several critical government websites with information on COVID only supported up to TLS 1.0.
Which, by the way, circling back, is why I think them using the thing of giving developers an excuse is good. I mean, we started talking about other things, Mark, but I was going to share our perspective on that. Is we obviously support TLS in our product, and we support it in a different way because we have proxies. We have to kind of support it at even a higher level than just an average website. And often, even when we changed our defaults and did everything by default the most secure, we had to leave this like product decision of giving a checkbox to allow people to still turn things on. We have kind of changed that now finally. But the reason that was there were for things like people still using IE8 browsers or these websites that still use 1.0 despite all this advice, especially if they're a government site. So we want to do the right thing. We really do. But if some customers, you know, still has a site they're going to that are technically doing the wrong thing, we sometimes have to hold on support for something we kind of want to get rid of just to give that customer an option, even if it's not our default. So I personally even like their excuse of giving developers an excuse to force the move, because we would like to give you the strongest and most secure defaults as we can, but the interoperability issues that just exist in a slow-moving industry are hard for us to work around.
Yeah, exactly. Like that's been one of my biggest frustrations, I guess, is when you're on the inside seeing how the hot dog is made, and you have to understand that, you know, sometimes you have to support, you know, hopefully not by default, but at least support some of these outdated protocols for those one-off people. It's frustrating seeing that that's still a necessity in this day and age. Because like you said, like there's people out there still using Internet Explorer 8, which just
blows my mind. It has to be some kiosk, some unmanned machine that still has that. It can't be an actual human that chose to.
There's no human that old.
Oh, shut up. I remember the first version of Netscape. When I had to dial in to use the internet.
Vaguely remember that. But either way, this does look like the beginning of the end. So they're now officially deprecated, which means maybe in our 1000th episode in 2031, we'll look back on, see how adoption is still being used. But it's at least the beginning of the end for two protocols that really deserve to die quite a bit ago, I'd say. So moving on to our last section, one of the things that's always come to my mind as we do this podcast is we pretty often talk about web application security vulnerabilities, like the OWASP top 10, things like cross-site scripting or SQL injection. And we tend to say these are solved issues, meaning there are solutions and programming methods and technologies out there that are designed to combat a lot of these vulnerabilities. And what I wanted to do was for the next few weeks, each episode or maybe each other episode, depending on how long it takes to come up with the content, cover some of these common vulnerabilities and then some of the protections that were designed to combat them. Talk about what it is, what they do, and how to implement it. And so I figured for this week, we could start with one of the most common web app flaws, which is cross-site scripting, where an attacker injects JavaScript code into a web page and then talk about one of the solutions for it. So Corey, maybe you want to start off with a quick, what is cross-site scripting and what are some of the types of it?
Yeah, sure. So cross-site scripting is essentially an attack where a web application, a website, is not really kind of parsing and making sure that you're not able to enter reserved characters and stuff in a way that I might be able to somehow insert some script so that it runs in the context of that web application itself. So, you know, me as a user, I could find a vulnerable place in your page where it's looking for the user to give the website some information, but I take advantage of that to add script that you really didn't expect, but you're not actually cleaning properly. And when, you know, that happens, your website will run that script as though it's its own code. And this is typically JavaScript, by the way, or this is JavaScript. So the nerds out there know that there's a lot you can do with JavaScript. But that's a very high-level description of it. There's actually a few types of cross-site scripting. And you know, it always has to do with some sort of input, the web application allowing some sort of input from a user or from they're expecting input from some sort of machine or browser or something else, but it's input that a hacker can control in some way. And the two most common types I talk about the most, but there's a third Mark will cover too, are called stored or reflected. And stored is essentially when you have a type of site, you know, it could be a forum where users can post something. It could be like Facebook on social media. It could be anything where the content that you're allowing input from external users is stored somewhere in the database of your site for a long time, persistently, so that other users or at least the local user can see it. So what I mean by that, a very common example, is if you have a cross-site scripting vulnerability in the mechanism you use to allow form posts, I could write some JavaScript. I could set up, go to that post place, enter a fake post, but also insert some JavaScript into that post that shows up on your website under my forum user. Anyone that goes to that forum to see what my post was, it executes that JavaScript in the context of the website itself and does something bad. What is the something bad? Well, there's kind of two angles. First, because it's executing in context of the web application, it pretty much can do anything that you could do on that website. So that means read your cookies. That means potentially take over your session. That means basically have access to that web application as though it were you, because the script is running in the context of whoever visits it. By the way, there's also client implications. You should look into the Beef exploit framework, because JavaScript does run on your client. There's sometimes ways to even do stuff on your computer, but you do have to break some sandboxes in some cases. So that's the stored one, and it's stored again because this forum post just will live as a post on that site forever, and every person that visits it could encounter this script until the web administrator or whoever realizes that something's there and cleans up the script. Reflected is different in that reflected that it's usually happening in some sort of input that's a one-time thing. You know, when you go to pages, there might be parameters that when you visit a page after logging on to a site as you, there might be automatic parameters built into the URLs you go to every time you click links that is basically sharing some data that this is Corey now moving to this page. So here's the data to let you know it's Corey. But if for reflective cross-site scripting, I'm injecting a script into one of those parameters. And the main difference is it only happens when you're visiting that URL with the script injected in the parameter. So it's a one-time thing. It's not going to show up on a page forever. Typically, you have to get a user, like a bad guy would have to get me, Corey, to click on a specialized link when I'm going to XYZ site that suffered from a vulnerability. And if I click that link, then it would then gain the context of me on that site. But because it's reflected, it only happens when you actually click on the link or go to the link. So those are the two that I know the best. There's another one called a DOM cross-site scripting, which you have to understand a little bit about web coding. So why don't you cover that one, Mark?
Yeah, so DOM-based XSS is basically where the attacker abuses the website code itself, the DOM, so the document, the page, to cause it to execute code in some unexpected manner. Like a really good example of this is, let's say a website wants to print out the contents of its URL path onto the page itself. So maybe it makes a call to the document write function within JavaScript, and it pulls that URL out of the document.location.href variable. If they don't properly sanitize that variable before running it through that function, though, an attacker that has control over the URL might be able to escape that document write function and do something else. So maybe they control the URL path, they put in some escape characters, and suddenly they trigger the page to pull out all of your session tokens and fire it off to an attacker. It's a little bit more of a rare one, I would definitely say these stored and reflected ones are the more common forms of cross-site scripting, but this is also one of the more difficult ones to defend against.
By the way, DOM is definitely rare. I would say, and I'm curious if you agree, Mark, that right now the reflected is the most common. To me, stored is one of the most dangerous because it can affect more than... It can affect anyone going to a page. It just sits there. But I feel like, you know, all web admins' knowledge of cross-site scripting and how bad it is a little different. But I feel like the stored ones were causing the most issue right at the beginning. And a lot of web admins have cleaned those up. And now it's the reflected ones and the DOM ones that are more common nowadays, even though they're kind of harder and have less impact. And part of that, by the way, is notice when I was talking about the place you can, when we talk about it might be a script that someone throws in a forum post. It's pretty easy for you to think of a user input on a website being something a human does, but there's all kinds of inputs, technically user inputs, because from the web application, anything coming from externally is a input, not theirs. But there's a lot of machine inputs that websites take. You know, every time a website's trying to read the headers, you as a typical user don't have control of the headers your web browser uses. But there's cross-site scripting buried in a lot of places. But anyways, for the stored ones, I feel like those are the simple ones and the ones that have been cleaned up the most. And I feel like it's the reflected ones that are more common, are probably the most common nowadays. DOM are less common because they're more complex, but they're also probably the harder ones for web administrators to find and clean up if they don't really understand how things work. Would you agree?
I'd agree entirely with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And when it comes to cross-site scripting, basically you are trying to prevent your browser from executing code from untrusted sources. And your browser just on its own has no idea whether any given script tag in line in the document or any given external script is something that's supposed to be there or something that was somehow injected by an attacker. And that's where content security policy comes in, or CSP, which when configured...
Before we jump into that, just to let you know why this is so important, why content security is, you probably don't realize how many JavaScripts from external sources that some websites launch. I think we've talked about it before, but me and Mark like these plugins called NoScript and ScriptSafe because they give users a little bit of control of when to actually run JavaScript. Hopefully with CSP, you may not need this in the future, but we like these tools. But the reason I bring it up is if you go to a page like CNN and you watch NoScript, you're going to see 40 to 50 domains that are not CNN. These are external domains. They could be Google Analytics. They could be some weird web app, software as a service that gives CNN some special ability on their site. But there's like 50 different places where JavaScript is running from when I visit one CNN page. So I just wanted to kind of illustrate the complexity. When Mark says your browser doesn't really know where script is coming from without some mechanisms, which he'll talk about in a second, that is the problem. A lot of modern websites today want to allow legitimately running JavaScript from a lot of sources, but that also opens up this opportunity of what's legit and what is not. Anyway, sorry, Mark, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Just wanted to mention, I don't think people realize how many different domains they touch when they visit one specific site.
Yeah, and that's exactly where CSP comes in. Like, it's pretty simple, or at least it seems simple, in that it's really just a response header in the HTTP response with instructions for the browser, but it actually can be a little bit difficult to implement without planning and sometimes rewriting code. Once configured, though, it basically tells the browser exactly where it's allowed to load external scripts from, and then what to do with inline scripts as well, and including protections to make sure that if you do allow inline scripts, ways for the browser to identify which are legitimate and which may have been injected. So CSP, it governs really everything, not just JavaScript. It covers everything that a page, in this case a DOM, could load externally. Like, it can cover scripts, you can choose where to allow images to be loaded from, where style sheets can be loaded from, where form actions can send form data off to. But the most common case for this is typically the script source tag. So specifically specifying where JavaScript can run from and what it's allowed to do. Like I said, it starts as just a simple header. It's called content-security-policy. And it's then just a bunch of different values, keys and values with different fields that you can configure. Each tag takes a few different arguments. For example, it can take sources, so where the script can come from, whether it be self, so just the domain that you're browsing to, or specific individual domains, or even wildcard domains. And then it's got a whole bunch of other tags along too, telling the browser which types of script it can run. Like for an example, if you had a content security policy to allow scripts from anywhere, so just a wildcard, you could still lock down specific types of JavaScript. There's a flag in there called unsafe eval that I think we talked about a few episodes ago in one vulnerability we were discussing, which basically allows the browser to run the eval method in JavaScript, which is the most dangerous method, but also has legitimate uses in frameworks like Angular or React, where you may want to allow it. You can also specify with the unsafe inline tag that tells the browser it's allowed to run scripts that are in line with the script elements within the actual HTML code itself, or event handlers or JavaScript URIs. When it comes to sources, you can just use the tag called self, meaning that the origin of the page has to match where the page itself was loaded from. So what I mean by is if I set watchguard.com with a content security policy header only allowing JavaScript from self, that means I could only allow content from HTTPS watchguard.com. It wouldn't load it from HTTP because that's a different URL scheme. It wouldn't allow it from HTTPS content.watchguard.com because a subdomain is technically a different origin. It would all have to be just on watchguard.com. To get around that, though, you can also specify specific origins too and include wildcards. So I could instead change that to say HTTPS *.watchguard.com to allow all subdomains, or just flat out star to allow all external sources. You might create a CSP rule that says script source star with nothing else. That would allow all externally loaded scripts, but it would block inline scripting because it emits that unsafe inline tag, meaning that if an attacker tried to inject something into the page itself instead of loading it externally, the browser would block it. You can get even more granular with inline scripts. So there's a tag called a nonce, which is a number used once. But this one's a little more difficult to implement because you have to actually program the web server to set this tag to be unique and randomly generated every time one of these policies are set. So anytime someone makes a request out to that page and loads it. And you also have to have it set that same nonce value as an attribute within each script element in the page. So it takes a bit of work, and if you get it wrong, those script elements are not going to fire. And it could potentially break something legitimate on the page. But if you get it right, again, you're protecting your page and your users from injected JavaScript. One of the good things about content security policy and much of the technologies that we're going to talk about over the next few podcasts is many of them come with a reporting-only mode where you can set it up with all the rules that you think would be perfect for your site, but then in a mode that isn't going to block anything. Instead, the browsers will just fire off an alert to a specific location that you instruct it to. And that way you can see if there's anything really big that you missed that could cause something to break.
That's good because we really recommend web owners use a content security policy. But back to the CNN example, when you have these big sites that actually have a lot of off-domain content that they do want to legitimately use, you could see how these rules would stack up. So I really love this reporting only because, you know, your smart web security guy can set up a policy and see where he missed something before the mistakes actually happen in production. I will say it does add extra work of, you know, there's probably a marketing department that's trying to make some advertising deal with some external company. It's going to make them a little bit harder to get whatever new ad placement you want on your site or something. But I think it's worth the effort. You'll just have to update your CSP rules as you make new partnerships.
It's similar to what many administrators have had to deal with email security and like anti-spam technologies, things like DMARC and SPF. where you can set those up in reporting mode only also, so that you can see if, oh, we forgot that our marketing team uses MailChimp to send out mass emails, and those would have been blocked if we had just turned it on right away. Like you said, these are really great to have reporting only modes for these things, because it lets you catch all those issues before they actually become issues, while still letting you set it up and test it out in a way that browsers will actually
use. In fact, I think we could translate this as a general security tip, even with our products. I mean, we have cool things like application control, where if you really use application control to lock down where your users, what internal and external, or well, mostly external network-based applications your users can use, you probably will improve your security quite a bit, but you'll obviously maybe have some help desk calls. But application control can be in a report-only mode. IPS can be in a report-only mode. For whether it's our IPS or someone else's, there are sometimes cases of false positives. So you can really turn your IPS temporarily into an IDS, a detection-only system, and quickly see if some signature pops up all the time. So I think this is kind of just a general security hack, that any security control that has report only is your easy way to get into starting to use it without affecting your production.
Yeah. And when it comes to CSP, like, it's not perfect. There are still some ways that if you don't lock it down correctly, there are ways technically that cross-site scripting can still sneak in through the door. I mean, the good news is once you do start locking it down, it makes it significantly more difficult. And that's basically all security is raising the bar for difficulty for an attacker to try and accomplish something on your network, or in this case, your website. Like, you'll never be 100% secure, but if you make it really dang difficult, maybe they'll move on to someone else. For example, with content security policy, though, some common mistakes are allowing external sources like Google APIs that can host things like JSONP, so JSON with padding, which allows an attacker potentially to inject code through these APIs. Also loading up sites that have support for frameworks like Angular or React, where an attacker can then use those frameworks to then execute something on your site by loading them through that domain. So like I said, like, there's quite a bit of work that you typically have to do to get this set up correctly. But once you have content security policy set up correctly for your site or your web app, it makes it significantly more difficult to launch a cross-site scripting attack. It mitigates the overwhelming majority of them, making it really difficult for them to actually happen. So like we said, content or cross-site scripting, it's been around for quite some time, but it is basically a solved issue. It takes a little work, but you can configure defenses like content security policy to protect against it. I'll make sure we link the OWASP guide to content security policy in the show notes for this, so that if you do maintain your own web apps or your own web servers, or you just want to learn more on it, you can get some more information from the real experts. But I thought this would be a good first foray into an overarching series on discussions of specific web app vulnerabilities and their protections. So, Corey, anything else you want to add other than maybe it's 2021 and we shouldn't allow things like SQL injection or cross-site scripting anymore?
Not really. I'm excited for this series. We get to talk a little more in more geeky depth. You know, as I think you said, the reason we tend to say this is solved isn't because, you know, everyone solved it, but it's because OWASP, the Open Web Application Security Project, has answers to how to do code properly in these situations. So always refer there, but I think it'd be fun to cover some of these topics in more detail, Mark. So I'm glad you're doing it.
Awesome. And it's been something like 50 minutes now, so I guess it's probably time that we let our listeners go and enjoy the rest of their commute. Well, no one's really commuting anymore. Maybe just the rest of your
time. I know one partner in Canada who listens to us on car drive sometimes. They're doing a little better with the pandemic.
Man, lucky them. Someday we'll be able to commute somewhere again. Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, you can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at @XORRO_. Corey is at @SecAdept, and the both of us are at #the443podcast. Thanks again for listening, and you will hear from us next week.